Good morning and welcome. My name is Joy Fleming, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's musicians and presenters, the seven-time Salt Early Music Ensemble. Dan Myers plays recorders and flutes, Karen Berciaga, Renaissance violin, Josh Schreiber-Shalem on viola da gamba, and Matthew Wright on lute. We also thank today's sponsor, the Putnam Foundation. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. Today's talk will be available on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, as a podcast within a few days. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is largely supported through contributions from audience members. That's you, whether you're listening on the podcast or here. We deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in the glass bowls in the church and in the parish hall. Thank you for your generous support. Our presenter today is the Seven Times Salt Early Music Ensemble. Welcome to Seven Times Salt. What kind of a name for a band is that? Anyone here know the origin of the name? Oh, I see a few hands, and I'm sure a few podcast listeners know. How many think they may know where the name comes from? Oh, this is wonderful. Think about Shakespeare. Around 1600, Shakespeare's writing Hamlet. Poor Ophelia has gone mad, and Hamlet's friend Laertes laments, "Oh, heat, dry up my brains. Tears, seven times salt, burn out the sense and virtue of mine eye. By heaven, thy madness shall be paid by weight till our scale turn the beam." Laertes is so upset at Ophelia's madness, he wants his brain to dry up and his eyes to burn with really, really salty tears. But think not that all the music performed by this group will be sad and lamenting. They bring to concertgoers a wide variety of music played in the Renaissance. Happy, sad, dance tunes, and as we've just heard, drinking tunes. Very nice job there. They characterize their genre as English consort music. But what is a consort? During the Renaissance period in England, any group of instruments that played together as an ensemble was called a consort. It just meant to do something together. If the instruments in an ensemble were all of the same family, the ensemble might be called a recorder consort or a viol consort. If they were of different families, the ensemble would be called a broken consort. Every ensemble was different, in part because music of the Renaissance very rarely specified an instrument to be used for performance. Generally, composers wrote the music, and the musicians decided what instruments to play. So let us now open our ears and minds to early America, to the Plymouth Colony, and find out a little bit more about the musical lives of the early settlers. May I present this broken consort, Seven Times Salt.
Thank you. Easier, where today we'll be looking at a variety of music that the settlers of Plymouth Colony might have heard, been familiar with, or even sung and played themselves. Now, most of us learn that the Pilgrims, as they were later called, sailed on the Mayflower in 1620, landed on top of Plymouth Rock, and had a Thanksgiving feast with the natives. But in fact, the Plymouth settlers' story begins decades earlier in an England that was an incredible patchwork of different people with different beliefs and attitudes towards worship. You've just heard the Queen's Almon, one of the traditional courtly dances that Queen Elizabeth I would have known and danced to in the late 16th century. To keep the peace in this patchwork England, she managed a compromise between staunch Catholics, conforming Anglicans, and a huge variety of different Protestants, including Puritans, Brownists, Anabaptists, and the group that concerns our pilgrims, the Separatists. Separatists viewed the Church of England with great suspicion, believing it to be full of the old rituals of the Catholic Church that were not called for in the Bible, and the Separatists wanted to separate themselves from this church and worship as they wished. Queen Elizabeth I was relatively lenient towards the various religious groups, but in 1603, after her death, when James VI ascended the throne, was crowned King of England and head of the church, he started persecuting these various religious sects that he viewed as a huge threat to the nation. Members of separatist congregations were fined, harassed, attacked, and even imprisoned, and families began to fear for their lives. So a little bit later, you'll hear more about a particular congregation of separatists from the village of Scrooby in the north of England and their particular decision to emigrate. So these separatists were actually only half of the settlers who came to the New World in 1620. The other colonists who sailed on the Mayflower and the Fortune the following year were a random mix of people of different backgrounds and faiths, some of them middle class, some of higher station, a large number of servants, all of whom simply wanted to advance their fortunes and profit from the wealth they believed was waiting for them in the Americas, but none of whom particularly cared about freedom of religion. This was purely a business venture to them. In his writings later on, William Bradford called these people strangers. So now we're going to sing for you a psalm to represent our separatists, and we'll follow that with a song out of Shakespeare's Twelfth Night that any of the strangers might have heard in the taverns or theaters of London.
Oh God, my strength and fortitude, of course I must love thee. Thou art my castle and defense in my necessity. In whom I trust, the worker of my wealth, my refuge, buckler, and my shield, the home of all my health. When I sing loud unto the Lord, most worthy to be served, then from my foes I am right sure that I shall be preserved. The pangs of death did compass me and bound me everywhere. The flowing waves of wickedness dead put me in great fear. Out of waters great that would me overflow, and me delivered from foes that would have made me thrall, yea, from such foes as were too strong for me to deal with them.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was O Mistress Mine, which was mentioned by name in Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. We're trying to draw a connection between the colonists, the pilgrims, and the instrumentation and the music of their time. Our particular ensemble, we have Dan playing recorders of the period, sometimes a Renaissance flute, other times bagpipes. All these things would have been pretty common sights at this time period. Karen's playing the violin, no stranger to the Renaissance. You'll notice the style she's playing. She's playing on her arm as opposed to her neck. Josh is playing a viol da gamba, which means the fiddle of the legs. And it, it has a, you know, very much a cello range. And I am playing a lute, which was a pretty standard Renaissance instrument of the time all over Europe. These instruments were grouped together at a time called the Broken Consort by Thomas Morley, who in 1599 published a specific publication of arrangements for these instruments. It was the first time ever that a specific ensemble was called for. I mean, before that, you know, whatever you had around your house, you played. So this was, a business venture on Morley's part to actually have a specific instrumentation in mind. This drove the amateur market pretty well at the time. I mean, let's think about this. This is the Renaissance. So everybody probably spoke Latin and knew how to dance and most likely played the lute. I mean, it was just one of the things you did. Whether or not the pilgrims knew this music, we don't really know. They never talked about it. Chances are they weren't into it. But it was the newfangled thing at the time. And this was a time of enlightenment for a lot of people. Chances are some of them heard that. I mean, their main church in Scrooby was about a 3-hour modern car drive from London. So maybe they weren't getting out to the plays, but Shakespeare plays, I should say, but we have no evidence that they didn't know about it. So we're gonna go with that there was some oral memory in their travels of this music. So the next piece we're gonna play is from the collection I was just speaking of, Thomas Morley's Consort Lessons of 1599. This is a setting of a popular song at the time by John Dowland, which was called "Can She Excuse My Wrongs?" also known as the Earl of Essex Galliard. This is a pretty standard consort lesson. Lesson is just, you know, they probably used it to teach young people ensemble music. That's why they call it lessons. They're not exactly a beginner's, you know, my first consort book. It certainly is not that. You'll hear that we're going to play a strain, and then we're going to repeat the strain, but there's going to be some decorative loop, what they call divisions. Basically, the vocal line being broken up into various fast-moving passages, sort of like a mini lute concerto. Okay, so the next piece, Can She Excuse My Wrongs?
Thanks. So now we're going to talk about what's probably, for Americans, the least known part of the Pilgrim story, which is the fact that they spent over a decade, some of them, in the Netherlands, in a town called Leiden. This started out, the congregation we were talking about in Scrooby in northern Nottinghamshire. It was organized under a pastor called John Robinson, and also under the postmaster, William Brewster. As Karen was describing, a lot of these separatists were starting to fear for their property and their lives, and so they contrived to escape to the Netherlands. The Netherlands was well known at this point for having religious toleration. They'd already been fighting a war for almost 50 years against the Spanish crown, which at that time, through most of the 16th century, was in control of the Netherlands. And the Dutch were fighting for their independence, and they very strongly believed in republican values, in democracy rather than monarchy, and in freedom of religion. And so the separatists thought that it might be a good place to go. They had to try twice. In 1607, they hired a ship to carry the congregation to the Netherlands. They were betrayed by the captain, who sold them out to the authorities, and several of them were arrested and had their property confiscated. In 1608, however, undaunted, they tried again. This time, they mostly made it, although there was a concern about ships coming in, and the Dutch captain who was carrying them was concerned about being captured by an English ship, and so put several of the women and children off in lifeboats. In fact, that was who the English authorities went after. These women and children were then captured and imprisoned. Some of them were held in jail for up to a year. But since this was not in any way a capital offense, being a reformer, the only thing that they could do was levy a fine against you. And these people had already sold all their property in preparation for the journey. So finally, after almost a year in prison, the English authorities decided, well, they're broke anyway. They'll never be able to pay their fine, so we'll just let them go. However, many of them did arrive in Amsterdam in 1608. After a brief sojourn in Amsterdam, they moved on to the town of Leiden in 1609 because Robinson had arranged for the city fathers to grant them a space of a few city blocks to live just south of where the Pieterskerk is in the Netherlands now. The church services, however, had to be held in Robinson's house. He had the largest house among the settlers, not by any means large, but it was the only house large enough for all of them to congregate. They didn't have a church of their own during the time that they lived there. While they did have religious freedom, the men were only allowed to hold manual labor jobs by Dutch law, and these were a lot of people who were agricultural workers. They were used to being farmers and herdsmen. Instead, about half of them went to work in the textile factories, tanneries, things like that. It was extremely hard work, and it didn't pay very well. There was also, as time went on, a little bit of cultural conflict. The English were really, while they appreciated the Dutch commitment to religious freedom, they considered the Dutch themselves to not be a particularly godly folk, and they were worried that their children were picking up liberal Dutch values. The Dutch, among other things, did not spend the entire Sabbath in prayer and contemplation. They went to church on the morning and then did their business the rest of Sunday. The English were kind of put out by this, and they started a printing press, in fact, circulating pamphlets to try and get the Dutch to observe the Sabbath better. Pretty gutsy move when you're an extreme minority. But they believed in what they were doing. They did absorb some Dutch customs, though, like civil marriage, which they would later bring to the colonies, the idea that marriage was could be a contract that could be formalized outside of a church setting. And in fact, some of the settlers did intermarry with Dutch people and had partly Dutch families. So in 1619, however, the political situation began to get tenuous again. The Dutch government was cracking down on people who were not part of the Dutch Reformed Church. And in fact, in 1619, they passed a law forbidding dissident religious services. Now, this was mainly meant to attack Catholics, and it wasn't really enforced against other sects, but technically now, their services were illegal. Also, there had been a truce concluded in 1609, a 12-year truce concluded between the Dutch and the Spanish, a cessation of hostilities, and this was drawing to an end. And the pilgrims were worried that whether the Spanish succeeded in reconquering the Netherlands, and they would have to put up with the Inquisition for being not Catholics. That wouldn't have been a good situation. Also, at this point, ironically, even though the English were fighting on the side of the Dutch in this war, one of the conditions that James gave to the Dutch for his assistance is that if they won the war, he would be allowed to have direct royal control of any English congregations in the Netherlands. So that wouldn't have worked out much better for them. So they decided to leave. And in 1620, a group of about 60 of them left for Southampton on a ship called the Speedwell. A lot of times in this particular instance, it involved splitting up families because they decided that they would send the sort of youngest and strongest first, and they would leave the older people and the children behind and come back for them later. Well, in fact, they never did come back, and several of them, including John Robinson, remained in Holland until their dying day, and their descendants still live in the Netherlands. The people who did leave on the Speedwell went to Southampton to meet up with a ship called the Mayflower, and the Speedwell and the Mayflower were supposed to go together to the New World. In fact, the Speedwell had been leaking all the way from the Netherlands, and they decided that it wasn't going to make it to the New World, so they sold it. And while about a dozen of the people who were on the Speedwell gave up and just stayed in England, about 50 of them then crowded onto the Mayflower with 52 other people and made the famous journey across. So that is where we leave our tale. But it was definitely a big separation. Some of those people who had left the Netherlands had children there, had families there, had spouses there, who they never saw again because they took the risk of going on to England. And we have a little song about that later on. So this is a set of variations by the famous Dutch, the Dutch loved the recorder, and this is by a famous Dutch recorder player, Jan Jacob van Eyck, who worked as an organist at the Janskerk in Utrecht, but was paid an additional stipend to play his handflaut, his little recorder, in the churchyard in the evenings for the entertainment of passers-by. This is called The English Nightingale.
tasty tidbit and small beer went out looking for adventure. They arrived at night in a dark quarter at Crazy Nancy's door. Small beer spoke with cunning. How do we get in here? I'll give it a try with a knock. Who's there? She asked. It's small beer, he said. No way, there's nobody home. But who's that with you? Spoke the pretty girl, peeping through a crack. He said, it's Tasty Tidbit. Oh, Tasty Tidbit, are you there? She opened the door fearlessly, and they all enjoyed themselves beyond description. But if Tasty Tidbit hadn't been there, small beer would have been left out.
So now a Dutch ballad by the playwright and composer G.A. Bradero. Translation of the first verse is, now my love's bobbing on the roads of the restless rising waves, on the grand and spacious sea that he, alas, must now go sail. Sail away, as winds prevail, and always think, where'er you be, on she who loveth thee.
Mit sterbarheit mein Verbi, A transatlantic journey in 1620 would have been a challenge under any circumstances. But the Mayflower was further burdened, as we heard Dan say, by delay, overcrowding, and underprovisioning because of the faltering of the speedwell, which had proved unseaworthy at the start of the journey. The delay forced the colonists to make a difficult passage in the late fall. And if you could imagine that, you live in New England. And they arrived in the winter in Plymouth Harbor and had to spend the winter there aboard the overcrowded ship, during which time 45 out of the original 102 colonists had died. While the colonists themselves might not have called their first harvest celebration in the fall of 1621 a Thanksgiving, that term was applied to a religious celebration giving thanks to God upon the arrival of new settlers and supplies in 1623. It is true that the settlers had the good fortune of encountering natives who spoke English and the good sense to befriend and make alliances with them and, yes, celebrate a first harvest with them. These early peace treaties with local tribes helped ensure both physical safety and a source of revenue from fur trading, with which to pay debts owed to the Merchant Adventurers Corporation, which had funded the colony. An initial payment that would have come to over $100,000 in today's money was intercepted by the French and never reached the creditors. But more settlers did come, bit by bit, some from the congregation back in Leiden, others from England, and, as Karen said earlier, not necessarily Calvinist separatists by inclination, though all were expected to show up at church on Sundays. By 1630, the colony numbered a modest yet perhaps more stable 300 souls. We tend to think of the pilgrims as a dour lot these days, and it is true that their style of worship was quite spare. But they were people after all, and they found time to amuse themselves out of church with music and dance. We know, for instance, that the manifest of one of the earliest settler ships included a bass viol, more or less like the one I'm playing today. So right now, what we will perform for you is a psalm, the 100th psalm, and we will start it more or less like they might have done it in church, all in one melody, and then we will do a harmonization from the period, and we will follow that with diversions.
Shout to Jehovah the earth, serve ye Jehovah with gladness, before him come with singing mouth. Know that Jehovah a God is. 'Tis he that made us and not we, his folk and shape of his fading. Oh, with confession enter ye. His gates, his courtyards with praising. Confess to him, bless ye his name, because Jehovah a God is. His mercy ever is the same, and his faith unto all
Okay, I'm going to make this short introduction because I think it's a really important aspect of what was going on at the time that doesn't get addressed until right now. There was Governor Bradford, you know, the head honcho, became very intolerant of people who he used to just call, as Karen said before, he just called them strangers and was like, well, they'll do their thing, we'll do our thing. But he became increasingly intolerant of people going against the grain. And there was one particular gentleman named Thomas Morton. And in modern day Quincy, Massachusetts, he started a colony of his own called Marymount. He built a giant maypole. He invited the natives to come and drink and dance with him. And not only that, he treated them like business partners. He gave them weapons and, you know, taught them about various things about economy that they had no idea about. And Bradford thought this was nuts. I mean, the colonists themselves, they had a zero tolerance policy about anything savage. That included nature, which is ironic because they basically lived in a camp. So the song we're going to do right now was based on a poem that this Thomas Morton wrote in celebration of his newfound friends in the natives. And there was a moment where Bradford sent Miles Standish out to get Morton, to, you know, chain him up, send him back to England. And, you know, we have no business with these savages. And Thomas Morton was just so perplexed by this that he called Bradford the savage. Anyway, this next piece is called Drink and Be Merry.
Iman's joys to Iman now. The day is come. About the merry maple, take a roam. Make green garlands, bring bottles out, and fair sweet nectar freely about. Uncover thy head and fear no harm, for here's good liquor, keep it warm. And drink and be merry, merry boys, set all delight in Iman's joys.
Real fast, I promise. The early years of Plymouth still faced economic hardship, but fortunately after the deaths of the first winter, they remained fairly healthy. The 1630s brought a better economic situation. There was trade with the Massachusetts Bay Colony. We slowly started to pay off their debts. In the early 1640s, news began to reach the settlers of civil unrest. Civil unrest. Back in Back in England, a man named Oliver Cromwell, whom they're coming for right now, had taken up arms against the king, who by then was Charles I, James's son, along with the Puritan roundheads, as they were called, and in fact, some of Plymouth's men returned to England to fight in the Civil War. And that's a story for another time. We're going to leave you with one last dance piece, a beloved English dance tune that has been known since before Queen Elizabeth I's time, right up to the modern day, Half Hannigan.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew, 7 times salt. Dan, Karen, Josh, and Matthew. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio.